be seated. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Benchmark Bank versus Crowder.
May it please the court, Mr. Roland Love and Mr. Trent Schedule will present arguments for petitioner. Petitioners are for 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Love will open with the first 10 minutes. He will also present the rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honor. We are truly honored to be here today. My name is Roland Love with the law firm of Colley, McDonald, Love & Devin in Dallas. Mr. Bezel is also with that firm and my colleague. As rookies to this process, you can see that we've elected to try to split the argument. We're not married to that, and certainly we'll answer questions of the court and present the argument as time permits. Initially, Your Honor, I want to present to the court basically a restatement of what occurred. The property involved is Frank and Marion Crowder's homestead. There is no issue as to that. The Crowders operated a small insurance agency with Mr. Frank Crowder as the licensed recording agent. That agency was incorporated in 1983.
When the original loan was made, the bank knew it was a homestead?
Yes, there is no question that the property was homestead.
At the time of the original loan?
Yes.
And do the papers reflect the Crowders acknowledging that it was their homestead?
The loan file is replete with references to the fact that it's homestead. It's indicated their address. I don't think there is any issue in this case but that all parties knew that this was the Crowders' homestead.
So when the loan was made, it was clear to the bank that they were lending money
secured by the homestead
of
the Crowders. Yes, Your Honor. I do not believe that there is any issue as to that in this case. There was notices of tax lien of record as to all property owned by Frank Crowder. Also notices of record of lien as to all property owned by Frank Crowder Insurance Agency, Inc.
But not property taxes.
And these were payroll taxes, 940 and 941 taxes. As in the Rogers case, which I'm going to get to, it is a federal tax. The Rogers case was a wagering tax. Ingram was an income and a profit and a 940 tax. So taxes under the federal system, once that lien is filed, attach to all the property interests of the taxpayer. I don't believe that that is an issue here either. I think all parties agree these were 940, 941 payroll taxes for the insurance agency. As I was saying, Frank Crowder was the sole director, sole shareholder, as the president of the corporation. Marion Crowder was the acting corporate secretary. Mr. Fossey had advised me that one of the exhibits I handed the court today says that she was the corporate secretary. I do not mean to mislead the court. The request for admission 21 was that Marion Crowder was the acting corporate secretary. The Crowders have always contended that Ms. Crowder could not be a corporate secretary because she was not a licensed agent.
Well, to clear it up, you don't contend that she was an officer of the corporation.
Yes, we do contend that she was an officer of the corporation simply because there is a law and the insurance code that says an agent, that to be an officer, he must be an agent. Doesn't mean that the corporation was set up with Marion Crowder as the secretary of the corporation. There is in the record that she was the acting corporate secretary of the corporation.
And that's the evidence.
Yes, Your Honor. The corporate privileges were lost many times, but particularly ones of reference here are in 1985 when the Secretary of State of Texas forfeited the charter of the corporation, and those were not revived until June. During that period, there were taxes that were not paid. There were also liens assessed. Somewhere in mid-1985, without resignation, Marion Crowder quit working with the corporation, had some illness, and began to stay at home. But under the facts of these cases, that should not be determinative of what this court is looking at today. Tax liens were assessed and filed as record as to Frank Crowder and as to the corporation. Both Frank and Marion borrowed money from the bank to pay off the lien held by the Internal Revenue Service. The Internal Revenue Service set the number that was required to pay off the lien and then of record released those liens. They defaulted on the loan to the bank. They did not tender any money. They did not object to any foreclosure. They did not request any segregation of assets between exempt and non-exempt. Why that becomes relevant here, Your Honors, is because there was 0.85 acres in excess of the urban exemption for homestead. It was a 1.85 acre tract. The Crowders filed suit to declare the lien invalid for wrongful foreclosure and claiming that there was a breach of the deed of trust and the power of sale, because the IRS would have had to proceed under judicial foreclosure, and the deed of trust gave them non-judicial foreclosure privileges. The district court found that the deed of trust lien was valid. The Court of Appeal found that the lien was valid, but that it only remained in the hands of the Internal Revenue Service, that the bank could not be subrogated to that lien, and that a deed of trust lien holder was subject to the same requirements as a judgment creditor and had to segregate exempt from non-exempt assets before foreclosure, a situation which requires a deed of trust lien holder to be somewhat clairvoyant and will upset foreclosure law in this state. Our outline of argument is as handed to the court. Time permitting, Your Honors, the main points that this court needs to address today is the opinion of this Court of Appeals, which finds that there can be no subrogation to a federal tax lien, and then that the deed of trust lien holder must segregate exempt from non-exempt before foreclosure on its lien.
Mr. Love, this does not, the IRS didn't transfer this lien to the bank, did it?
There is no formal transfer document. Internal Revenue Service provided the payoff number, filed certificates releasing the liens. That is the only written documentation of the company.
Is there any question in this case about when the IRS releases, being subrogated to a lien that's been released?
Under the principles, there's two types of subrogation present here, Your Honor. Under equitable subrogation, there would be subrogation when one who has an interest steps forward to pay off the debt of the debtor. That's the American Surety MB Ice Cream case, which the Commission of Appeals has already decided in this state, where corporate income taxes were paid off and the surety was subrogated to the federal government's tax lien in that situation. There was also contractual subrogation whereby the deed of trust, the Crowders agreed that the bank would be subrogated to any liens that were paid off or any encumbrances upon the property that were paid off out of the proceeds of the loan, and that's exactly what happened. All of these loans proceeds went to the Internal Revenue Service to pay off the taxes against the Crowders. Under the decision as it exists now, the only thing a taxpayer can do if he can't pay his taxes is to await foreclosure by the Internal Revenue Service.
Has the legislature changed that?
Your Honor, the Texas legislature has passed a bill put on the vote to the public, a constitutional amendment. Yes, and the legislative history in that is very clear that the reason for that is this very case. Because the legislature has seen this opinion, it has shut down lending within the state, and the inability of a homeowner to protect his homestead from the Internal Revenue tax lien. It also does not say whether it will be retroactive, and it doesn't deal with potentially a situation here where you have an innocent spouse argued by Marion Crowder. The legislation which is pending deals with the tax debt of those spouses. We contend that it was a tax debt of those spouses, but certainly under Rogers and 7403, there was a lien as to the entire homestead. And the only way to protect that homestead was to borrow money to pay off the tax lien. This was the only way the Crowders could remain in that home that they had for some 20 years, as they contend in the record. Under the present decision, all the Crowders could have done is wait for the Internal Revenue Service to take the property by foreclosure, hope a party doesn't buy it, hope the Internal Revenue Service ends up with it, and hope that they can buy it back and try to create a purchase money lien in that manner. It's illogical. It's a game full of chances. And it runs contrary to the law already existing in this state, as exemplified by Staley versus Vaughn out of the Court of Appeals in Amarillo. In that case, Mr. Vaughn had paid off the tax lien and took a note and deed of trust. The taxes were only owned by Cleta Staley in that case. Her husband, C.R. Staley, signed on the deed of trust. The court found that Mr. Vaughn was subrogated to the federal tax lien in that situation and that his foreclosure was valid. Staley versus Vaughn is precedent. This court, writ refused, no reversible error in that situation, has been the law of this state for many, many years. And to distinguish between subrogation as to whether or not it's a state government entity or whether it's a federal government entity flies in the face Supremacy Clause of the United States Constitution, and also Article 1, Section 1 of our Constitution of the State of Texas, in which we say that the Texas State Constitution is subjected to the U.S. Constitution. And in Article 6, Clause 2 of the Supremacy Clause, it doesn't say that this is a right of the sovereign. It says the laws of the United States will be superior to the laws of the state. And in Rogers, the U.S. Supreme Court so found.
The bank is subrogated to the land and there were not a deed of trust, would the bank have any greater enforcement rights than the United States?
Your Honor, no, it would not. If it is equitably subrogated, it steps into the shoes of the Internal Revenue Service.
How does the deed of trust in this case give the bank greater rights if the homestead owners could not have agreed to those absent the taxes?
Your Honor, I must disagree with one part of your question, is that the homeowners could agree to those. What the Constitution says is that their property is exempt from forced sale for anything but the three instances, one including ad valorem taxes. As set out by this court in Matuszek versus Barczak, and additionally followed in Freitag by the Fifth Circuit. Freitag is a bankruptcy case, 155, bankruptcy 150, and then again in Smart and Diversified. In Diversified, there was a vendor's lien, which required judicial foreclosure. The court found subrogation and allowed, it said that the deed of trust prescribed new terms and conditions for foreclosure of the lien. Our Constitution doesn't deal with terms and conditions for foreclosure of the lien. Diversified allowed a non-judicial foreclosure right to be contractually and privately agreed. Again, in the Smart case, this court here has said that the deed of trust can prescribe new terms and conditions for foreclosure of the lien. Subrogation is to the security. It permits the debt to be secured by the security, by the lien. The lien is unchanged. These people's position did not change vis-a-vis the lien and their property.
But these people could not give the bank a lien in the first place, absent the tax lien. How can they agree to greater enforcement rights?
Because there is no prohibition as a matter of contract between you and me if we have a debt. When I renew or extend or otherwise need to revisit that debt, we can agree to new rights as between us by a matter of contract as to whether or not we are going, how we're going to foreclose that interest. In fact, the rights were in some ways expanded. The Internal Revenue Code is a 10-day notice for levy. Under this agreement, it became 21 days notice, so it's a right to pay. You can change or change the terms and conditions to deal with how we're going to foreclose on that lien. The federal tax law created the lien via the Supremacy Clause. In spite of what the Texas Constitution says, the federal tax laws create the lien. The bank becomes subrogated to that lien when it pays off that internal tax.
Without the lien, is it your position that a debtor can come to the bank, ask for a loan to pay, you know, April 14th, they want to pay their income tax, and they're give a deed of trust in that?
They could not do that, Your Honor. It's just the same thing as a mechanic's lien. If I want to go improve my home without the conditions prescribed by the Constitution, I have to have myself and my wife sign. There has to be a written agreement. It has to be filed with the Works Commission. In order to have this subrogation to that federal tax lien created by the federal tax law, there needed to have been a lien created by under the federal tax law. In this case, there was a lien assessed and created. There was even notices filed of the lien, and the lien was asked to Frank Crowder, and it's the Frank Crowder Insurance Agency.
And that's in loan papers as well?
The loan papers, the only loan papers here, Your Honor, are a note and deed of trust signed by Marion Crowder and Frank Crowder for $52,000 securing the note with their homestead. In the closing file, there is a payoff number provided by the Internal Revenue Service and the check written by the Internal Revenue Service to pay off that. And then subsequently, the release of liens of record by the Internal Revenue Service. Your Honor, in closing, I want to briefly point out to the court, I know I'm about to run out of time, and as rookies might have it, it looks like we did expect that we would run out of time. The court needs to understand the obligation, I mean, the right of the individual to restructure his note, the ability to change the payment terms, the ability to change the kind of notice I'm going to get. The ability is in Matichek to turn an obligation for comfort and aid into a monetary amount, or in Freitag to change the payment structure, to change the interest rate. In Smart, they prescribed, or in Diversified, they turned it in from a judicial foreclosure on a vendor's lien into a non-judicial foreclosure on the deed of trust lien. Those are not part of what this Constitution talks about. Our Constitution talks about protection from forced sale.
Mr. Love, before you sit down, Stanley versus Vaughn is not cited by the Court of Appeals.
The Court of Appeals completely ignored precedent.
Was Stanley versus Vaughn argued and part of the briefing before the Court of Appeals?
Yes, Your Honor. It was presented to the court in the briefs. It was part of the oral argument, and the opinion of the court made no reference to Stanley versus Vaughn.
Any other questions? Thank you, Commissioner.
May it please the court, Mr. Lawrence Balkin will present arguments for the respondent.
Counsel, why isn't Stanley versus Vaughn dispositive of this case?
Excuse me, Your Honor.
Why isn't Stanley versus Vaughn dispositive of this case?
Staley against Vaughn is light years away from this case. Yes. Staley against Vaughn was decided, I think, in 1932. The last time, to read the briefs in this case, I understand you might think it's the Marbury against Madison of Texas jurisprudence. It is simply not. The last time it was ever cited by any court in this state or anywhere else was 46 years ago. The only proposition for which Staley against Vaughn has ever been decided is for the fact that the Supremacy Clause allows the United States government to get a lien against a homestead, not that a private party can acquire that lien by way of subrogation. That issue was never joined in Staley against Vaughn. It was not the point of contention there. It was addressed tangentially, in a very glancing way, in a very cryptic way, and certainly it was dicta in light of the holding of Staley against Vaughn. Now, in fact, to read the briefs, for example, the Texas Land Title Association amicus brief says that lenders of all kinds, corporate and individual, public and private, have been willing to furnish funds to homestead owners to avoid foreclosure of validly existing federal tax liens by taking security of the homestead property under the principles of subrogation honored in Staley against Vaughn. Staley against Vaughn was not briefed by Benchmark Bank at the trial court, where there was the Crowder's motion for summary judgment and the bank's cross motion. They stumbled upon that case, and I think they did stumble upon it. It's an obscure case, only in the briefing at the Court of Appeals, and I think the Court of Appeals overlooked it for that reason. Now, there are some significant fact differences also in Staley against Vaughn. Fleeta Staley owned the property as her separate property. She owned the whole thing, Mrs. Staley. Now, yes, as Mr. Love said, her husband signed the deed of trust, but the Court of Appeals in Staley against Vaughn said that was pro forma. It is undisputed in that case that she owned the whole thing. Quite the opposite situation from this case. The Constitution of Texas says no deed of trust on the homestead shall ever be valid except for the purchase money or improvements. Now, what the bank's contention is that the law under Staley has always been different. That's not true. It never has been different. Moreover, we submit it should not be different as a matter of constitutional law and sound policy. And even if it were different, even if one could acquire by way of subrogation a federal tax lien to foreclose on a homestead, in this case, on this record with these facts, the bank's foreclosure is still wrongful because it had many deficiencies. Most egregiously, the bank had absolutely no lien rights against Marion Crowder because the Internal Revenue Service did not.
The IRS lien filed against Mr. Crowder would not have attached to real estate owned jointly between Mr. Crowder and Mrs. Crowder?
Well, that precisely right, Your Honor. And I want to show you what the tax lien says, and I want to remind you of what Section 7403 says, which is attached as an appendix to our brief. The federal tax liens, each and every one of them filed in this case. Now, I apologize. I know this looks minuscule to you. But this is in the record. It says, notice is given that taxes have been assessed against the following named taxpayer. It is always Frank Crowder or his corporation. Therefore, there is a lien in favor of the United States on all property and rights, excuse me, on all property and rights to property belonging to this taxpayer. What the interpretation, I believe that this is
that it doesn't, therefore that lien does not attach to any property owned jointly by Crowder and anybody else.
Absolutely not, and that's what the United States Supreme Court recognized in the United States against Roger. This lien attached to Frank's community property interest in the homestead. In Rogers, the court recognized that the innocent spouse has a vested community property estate. And it made a distinction between a forced sale and collection. It said you may force the sale of the homestead, including the innocent spouse's interest, but you may not collect from the innocent spouse. Here, of course, the bank forced the sale, and even assuming subrogation were allowed, it forced the sale and it collected from the innocent spouse. I think that the word property is thrown around in this case very loosely. Property does not just mean the entire real estate. It means, usually in these tax liens, it means Frank Crowder's community interest. And in United States against Rogers, the Supreme Court case that arose under Texas law, is very clear about that. Now,
is there some judgment here that you're appealing from of a monetary amount against Mrs. Crowder?
No, Your Honor. The posture of this case is that at trial court we sued for wrongful foreclosure after eviction from the property. We lost at the trial court on cross motions for summary judgment. The Court of Appeals reversed. It said the foreclosure was, in essence, was wrongful.
Okay, I misunderstood. I thought you said Roger stood for the proposition that you could take the property from the joint owned person, but you can't
collect
money from them or something, and you're saying that's what happened here.
That's what happened here. The bank collected all $52,141.51 of its debt, plus some trustees' fees, etc. It collected it by taking the entire property and bidding in the amount of the debt against it. It did not then, as Rogers requires it to, as Section 7403 of the United States 26 U.S.C. requires it to, pay Marion Crowder, compensate her for her interest in the property. Those cases and that statute explicitly require compensation to the innocent spouse. You may force a sale of property that she owns an interest in, but you may not then collect.
That's your argument, the property was really worth more than what the bank bid in for.
No doubt about that.
Okay.
By a long shot. Okay. Its own expert says $365,000.
Counsel, the purpose of this constitutional protection is to protect the debtor, I presume.
It is indeed.
You'd agree with that?
I certainly do.
And what holding would best afford protection to the debtor, one that would would disallow any loan from a bank and that lien to attach or be subrogated to the IRS lien, or one that would, as your opposing counsel says, require them to just let the IRS foreclose?
Your Honor, that's a good question. I think my answer is that this court should hesitate to create a constitutional exception, because the legislature right now is addressing it. But even were this court inclined to do so, I believe that to create an exception that would allow a private party to be subrogated to the rights of the government and then not have constraints similar to what the government has is simply wrong. It's simply wrong. It hurts homestead claimants. Remember, in this case, the property was, if the IRS had foreclosed, if the IRS had done it, then it would have had to go to federal district court. There would have been an equitable proceeding, a judicially supervised sale. The first thing the court would have decided was whether to allow any sale, any forced sale of the property in the first place in view of the innocent spouse problem. And it would have weighed Marion Crowder's interest in the property. It would have weighed the possibility of undercompensation and dislocation costs. And it would have looked at other equitable factors. For example, in this case, the bank had 0.85 acres, which is a sizable lot, even by North Dallas standards, Your Honors. 0.85 acres it could have gone after. It didn't. It went for the whole thing. Certainly, if the court had allowed a foreclosure, if the federal district court had allowed the IRS to foreclose, there would have been payments to Marion Crowder based on an actuarial calculation that the Rogers case prescribes and that subsequent cases have adopted of her, of the value of her community property interest in that homestead. I would, at a minimum, there ought to be some court-supervised foreclosure procedure designed to assure that people in their 60s, like the Crowders, are not suddenly wiped out of their entire retirement equity savings in their homestead. That, at a minimum, ought to be done. Now, the IRS has filed...
That can only be argued, I take it by analogy, because the actual restrictions of the code could not be literally enforced. Couldn't bring suit in federal court.
Correct. This
federal court wouldn't have jurisdiction.
It would not. This court would have to fashion. This is one of the problems of this subrogation argument. You have a statute that contemplates action by a federal sovereign, and what you're now going to try and do is create a state overlay for it if you want to create this right. But I think the only way to do that and honor the homestead protection that this court has recognized for 150 years would be to create some state court procedure that's similar, that offers some sort of protection to the homestead claimant.
If that is the result, where does that leave the case?
If that's the result, Your Honor, that leaves the case, I think that leaves it affirmed for the following reasons. Even if you were inclined to create such a right, remember, the subrogee, the extent of his rights and the measure of his remedies is measured by what the subrogor had. That is black letter law, black letter Texas subrogation law. What right did the IRS have in this case? It had the right to collect for the value of the property interests that are actually liable for the debt. It says that at 461 U.S. 691. That's United States against Rogers. The IRS, the court said, we know this is a drastic remedy to go after an innocent spouse, but remember, the IRS can collect. The IRS may not ultimately collect as satisfaction for the indebtedness owed to it more than the value of the property interests that are actually liable for that debt. That's not a new principle, by the way. This court, exactly 100 years ago, in a case called Fares against Cockrell, said precisely the same thing. Okay, so what could the IRS collect out of this property just from Frank Crowder? From Frank Crowder, he was personally liable for $9,000 the day the loan proceeds were advanced. The IRS had a lien to the extent of $9,000 in his homestead. Now, there was also a $27,000 penalty assessment against him as a person responsible for making sure that these payroll taxes were withheld. Could that ever be acquired by way of subrogation? Let's assume for the moment it could be. Let's just assume it. 9 plus 27 doesn't get you the 52.
But doesn't that ignore the responsible person provision?
For liability to attach, for a federal tax lien improper to attach, the cases are clear. There has to be notice to the taxpayer and a demand for payment. The fact that hypothetically, possibly, we disagree, we don't think the facts are there, but even if they were, the IRS never sent Marion Crowder notice. It never demanded that she pay. The statute says it must give notice and demand, but the federal cases...
I thought you were talking about what Frank Crowder individually was liable for. So I'm making my reference to Frank Crowder. Wouldn't he, as a responsible person, be liable for the total amount of that tax lien individually?
Honor. He is not. And the reason is payroll withholding. These taxes that were owed by the corporation have three components. He's liable for two of them. Not three of them. There's the withholding, the employee's share of withholding, the employer's share, and then the Social Security taxes. The employer is liable for the trust fund part, which is the Social Security taxes and the employee's share of withholding, but not the employer's share. So it's always less. The penalty assessment is always less than the total tax obligation. Yes, by the way, the bank was subrogated. It was subrogated to the rights the IRS had against the corporation, but it wasn't interested in those rights. It wanted this homestead. The point, I think, is that possibly the Internal Revenue Service had some $36,000 or $37,000 that it could collect. The bank collected $54,000. Possibly, the Internal Revenue Service had a lien against the homestead interest of Frank Crowder. The Internal Revenue Service had no lien against any community property interest of Marion Crowder in the homestead. It would have had to compensate her, to pay her, had it foreclosed. Now, I think that if this court were to examine only a few cases, so many cases have been cited by everyone, but if you were only to look at a few, in my mind anyway, the two crucial ones would be the United States against Rogers case. We've talked about that. You can read Staley against Vaughn, by the way, and if you understand it any better than I do, then possibly some enlightenment may yet come from Staley against Vaughn. But I think United States against Rogers is clearly a seminal case. It's the 1982 United States Supreme Court case. But I think also very instructive is the case of Paddock against Semonite, I believe is what it's called. Paddock against Semonite, decided by this court in 1949 and cited by both parties. There, this Texas Supreme Court said that the foreclosure decree, there was a foreclosure decree because a husband had failed to pay some federal taxes that were due. And the court decreed foreclosure on the homestead property even though there was an innocent spouse. And the Texas Supreme Court said, no, we're invalidating that foreclosure because there's an innocent spouse. The rights of the Internal Revenue Service can only go to the culpable spouse's interest in the property, but not beyond that. Now, subsequent to that, in 1982, Section 7403 came into existence. It's written much more broadly. It allows the IRS to go get whatever interest the spouse who owes the taxes has, and Rogers, in essence, overruled this court's work in Paddock against Semonite, even though this court was operating against a somewhat different statutory background. Now, there's nothing you can do about the United States Supreme Court overruling what you do, of course. They have the atom bomb. They're the federal government. And there's the supremacy clause. However, it's ironic. In Paddock, this court took pains to protect the interest of the innocent spouse. In Rogers, the court said forced sale may still happen, but it acknowledged, and it quoted this court, it said, that's right, there is a vested estate for the innocent spouse. We're not going to allow collection against it. We're going to provide compensation for it, and we're going to create safeguards to assure that all reasonable steps are taken to protect it. Now, what the bank would have you do in this case is to go far, far beyond what Rogers would do, and to go contrary to what I think was the actuating principle of Paddock. It would have you permit subrogation and collection against not only, against far more than the amount of the property that's liable for the debt, of course, and to permit collection from the innocent spouse. Even Rogers did not require nearly so much, of course. It still protected the innocent spouse.
Now, I think Crowder had the opportunity to get all of this protection, didn't he? He had that opportunity to get all the protection you're talking about. It's what he's entitled to.
I'm not certain I understand your question.
He could have allowed the IRS to embark on judicial foreclosure and gone to federal court and had all these issues resolved.
I submit to you that the Crowders would have been far, far better off at the tender mercies of the Internal Revenue Service than they were at the hands of Benchmark Bank. Because I submit to you that no federal district court would have allowed the bank to go take the homestead before at least first segregating off the 0.85 acres. The federal court would have considered equitable circumstances not before this court. How about the check the Crowders came running in with a few days later that the bank returned and wrote void on it? Okay, those things would be the kinds of things a court of equity can consider. And so I guess they did have that opportunity. I wish they let the IRS go ahead and do it because they'd be far better off than they are today. But you're exactly right. They did have that opportunity. I think, my time is, I think, close to done, but in, how much time do I have? Okay. In this case, the notion that there's always been this right for a third-party lender to be subrogated to the rights of the United States sovereign, I think is a myth, and I think any honest look at Staley against Vaughan will bear that out. I think this court then has to write on a blank blackboard and determine what makes sense in the context of subrogation. The Staley against Vaughan case just doesn't get you there. No case that's been decided in this state has ever really addressed this question. It's for you to look at. There are some constitutional provisions of construction, I think, that are helpful. This court has always held. It's held this for more than 113 years, and it's cited it time and time and time since then, that in construing the homestead provision, you construe it in favor of the exemption and against the forced sale. It is always said that it's not for this court to judicially engraft an exception onto the Constitution. Even were this court inclined to do it, I would urge that it take a look at all the equitable factors that are present, that are listed in the United States against Rogers. Finally, I would submit that in view of the many deficiencies of the bank's foreclosure here, the Crowders are simply not the appropriate poster children for this campaign to create a new constitutional exception. Thank you, Your Honor.
Any other questions? Thank you.
May it please the court, by way of rebuttal, I would ask the court to not overlook the Ingram part of the Rogers case. I think Ingram is more instructive even than the Rogers part of that case. Ingram involved some income taxes and payroll taxes. In that portion, the court found that Mrs. Ingram was only liable for a couple hundred dollars of taxes, while Mr. Ingram was liable for several thousands of dollars, because she was liable for any portion of that debt, of that tax debt. Even the dissent in a 5-4 case, the Rogers case, it was a 9-0 case on the fact of subrogation being appropriate in that case. And by the reason I raise that, Your Honor, we by no means concede in any way that Marion Crowder is an innocent spouse in this case. But I don't think this court has to really deal with that issue, because Rogers in 7403 clearly create a right of forced sale of the entire homestead. And the only way Mrs. Crowder, innocent or not, was going to protect herself and her homestead from foreclosure by the Internal Revenue Service was by borrowing this money to pay off that tax lien. Mr. Fossey has injected new information here in the record at this argument regarding some check brought into closing, and I do object to that. That is not in the record, and I would point that out to the court. Staley versus Vaughan is not different because there was some separate property, because this was a homestead of which with the fee was separate property, because this court has held again and again and knows that the homestead interest belongs to the entire family, husband and wife. The state of Texas creates a property interest, a homestead interest, and C.R. Staley had that interest, and yet the court in Staley versus Vaughan upheld that foreclosure and that subrogation. Mr. Fossey even agreed that there was subrogation here to the Internal Revenue lien against the corporation. Somehow it becomes different when it's subrogation and there's homestead involved. Well, Roger says very clearly, state law creates the property interest, federal law creates the consequences, and sweeps aside state-created exemptions. That is the language of the United States Supreme Court. It is the federal law that determines the lien and the consequences of a net property interest. So under Rogers, the government had the right to force the sale, to maximize its tax collecting efforts of the entire homestead, and the Crowders acted to protect that interest. Certainly there were many attributes that are limitations upon what the federal government can do, and they had the right, the Crowders had the right to go through that process. But they chose, by reason of contract, we cannot restrict the citizens of this state the right to contract, to make agreement. And they chose to transfer, to pay off that tax so that the bank became subrogated to that lien. They contractually agreed voluntarily that the bank was agreed, was contractually subrogated to that lien, and prescribed new conditions for perfecting or enforcing payment of the debt. And they have that right, as citizens of this state, to enter into private contracts. The Criers would also seem to suggest that the amount of the tax debt makes a difference. Well, there is no law in this state that requires the creditor to bid in more than the debt. If this had been a 500, if it had been undersecured, this court needs to think about this. If it had been a $750,000 tax debt secured by a $200,000 piece of property, the issue is no different for this court here today.
Mr. Love?
Yes, Your Honor.
What was the amount of your original note?
$52,000.
$52,000?
Yes, sir. Additionally, Your Honor, there has been no claim by Marion Crowder for adjustment of the equities. She could have made that claim in this case. No, she went for a tort claim, for a wrongful foreclosure claim. She has made that choice. The issue of adjustment of equities is not here before this court. Finally, Your Honor, I would point out to the court that who knows what a sheriff's sale would bring. We keep talking like a sheriff's sale is going to be some kind of magic solution to the problem here. Well, that's what would have happened with the Internal Revenue Service. There would have been a sheriff's sale. And for us to speculate what price that would bring is just that, it's speculation. It's just a different way to enforce collection of the debt.
I thought Mr. Foster said that you cannot have a sheriff's sale, that you have to apply to the federal court for judicial control.
And that would be the result, Your Honor, would be a sheriff's sale, a judicial foreclosure. The court would enter an order, refer it to the sheriff for sale. There would be publication, there would be a public sale, and whatever price brings would be determinative of what would be received in this case. Then the court would determine how the proceeds of the sale would be divided. So we don't know what a sheriff's sale would bring in that situation.
Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
That concludes the argument and the second calls. The court will take another brief recess.
Can I take a drive?